Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
This session is called Alone Together, Cultivating Social Solidarity in the Year Ahead. And what we've asked Professor Frank Furedi to do is spoken throughout the festival, Professor of Sociology at the University of Kent, new book on tolerance in defence of moral independence, is to just give us some thoughts on this question of whether it's possible to build social solidarity today or whether we are to remain atomised, isolated individuals with no common purpose. He's going to give this as a lecture for about 15-20 minutes. I will take a few questions from the floor, but this isn't really a big open full debate. This is where we listen to what he said and argue about it over a beer in the bar when we go to the party. So, with no further ado, can we give him a big welcome, Professor Frank Furedi.
Thanks very much. I'd like to end with a few questions that I've been thinking about this year. And many of these questions, in a sense, have been put in perspective by some of the debates that I heard in the last couple of days. And they're basically to do with what is a very old philosophical problem. It could be a political problem, it could be a sociological problem. And that's to do with the paradox of a human being's dual individual and social nature. You know, the fact is that as human beings, we both have our aspirations for individual self-expression, but at the same time, we also are obviously social beings who live in relational dynamics, who've got an aspiration for solidarity as well. And this is a question that people have been struggling with for a very long period of time. In the 17th century, already in the 16th century, they began to try to invent the idea of a social contract to somehow account for some of these tensions, to make some sense of it. One of the points I want to emphasize is that today we find it very difficult to discuss that for the very simple reason that the legacy of the past in terms of politics, in terms of cultural developments, inhibits us from dealing with this question in a future-oriented, creative kind of a way. And therefore, invariably, whenever we're looking at this issue, we tend to counterpose the individual to the social. Solidarity is seen as the antithesis of the individual. And it's very rare that we can find a language through which the relationship between individual and solidarity can be mediated and understood in a way that corresponds to contemporary experience. And my argument is very simple. My argument is that today, you know, we find it very difficult to give meaning either to individual or to collectivities. It's very difficult. We do it in a very kind of perfunctory kind of a way. But we find it very difficult to discuss the individual in terms of individual attributes, in terms of what is it that we value about it as a society. And of course, whenever we talk about collectivities, we have this kind of fairly cynical and fairly desperate ways of making a sense of that. And I think one of the reasons why that is because you cannot discuss the individual or the collective without talking about interests. Individuals don't exist in the abstract any more than collectivities. We live in a world where, whether we like it or not, there is such a thing as an individual's interest. You know, sometimes they conflict with other individuals' interests, but there's also such a phenomenon as collective interests. The two really go hand in hand. And therefore, how do you express that? You know, how do you, you sort of give meaning to that. And of course, it's not that people have lost the ability to intuit what their interests are, or it's not that even communities have lost the capacity to explain what their interest really is. I think intuitively, we all know that. You know, even if it's a little bit pre-conscious, we're aware of the fact that that we have something that drives us that may well contradict or support the position or the status of another group or another individual. It's just that we live in a world where very often we're not allowed to express that. And one of the things that I really want to address here, because I think it's a very big problem, is that what we try to do is, you know, since the late 80s, 90s, is to somehow deal with the fact that there weren't any positive developments, there weren't any future-oriented possibilities, by basically disassociating interests from politics. I think one of the, if you look at the way that ethics and philosophy and social sciences and political thinking has evolved, particularly in the Anglo-American context, but a little bit more widely, it's somehow as if there's something wrong with having an interest. There's something wrong with having an individual's interest, a class interest, a community interest. There's something really kind of wrong with that. And essentially what that leads to is a political language which is deeply immersed in bad faith, where politicians, when they speak to us, speak in a way that is driven by their desire to, in a sense, resonate with what they think the public speaks. It's not that they get up in the morning and they say, I want to be dishonest, I want to be opportunistic, I want to be manipulative. They may well do that, but that's nothing unusual, nothing special. What they do instead is, how can I frame my words, my policies, in a way that resonates with the public? That's why you have the so-called spin doctors, that's why you have all these public relations consultants, because in a sense, it's about saying what you think people want to hear. Now, people are often very critical of politicians when they do that, and there's a very cynical tendency to criticize politicians just because they're politicians. And this was, you know, I mean, everybody had strong views against spin doctors during the Blair-Brown regime. It was very cheap to make snide remarks about it. But what we overlook is that spin doctor approach, that kind of framing approach, is also so powerful that you and I have absorbed it in the way that we're expected to conduct our affairs. It's not something that's out there, it's something that's within us. And the reason why it's within society is because these are culturally driven forces. So what is the politics of bad faith when it comes to you and me? Well, you know, I've just been talking to a bunch of young kids recently. They're 17, 18, 19. And their main concern was how to spruce up their CVs. And they were discussing, well, we've got to volunteer somewhere. You know, I mean, you know, you got to go out and volunteer. And it's very interesting because one of the young girls that was there wrote this kind of fantasy volunteering experience where she went to Chile. She helped build, you know, a well or some kind of a, you know, infirmary for the poor peasants, you know, sort of. And then she got back home to go to Oxford or Cambridge or whatever. And, you know, that's the way that the whole thing was kind of recast. And, you know, when I asked them, well, don't you think there's something wrong that already at your age, you know, you're 17, 18 or 19, you're kind of fantasizing about this volunteering, you know, sort of process, which is totally external to you. You know, when I say that, you know, what they will invariably tell me is that if they tell the interviewer at the college that they just want to go to Oxford because they want to make a lot of money, fair enough, or they want to go to Oxford because they're deeply interested in medicine, they care about nothing else, or they want to go to Oxford because they're, you know, absolutely fascinated by history, you know, we haven't got a language to say that. You got to find these external trappings through which those kinds of, you know, self-interested motives, you know, sort of are expressed. And I got to the point now where I haven't met a capitalist, a genuine capitalist, you know, for a very long time that says to me, you know, Frank, I'm actually a capitalist, and my main interest is to make a profit. Right? And that's what I'm really interested in, because when you meet capitalists these days, invariably they'll go on and give you a 2.5-hour lecture about business ethics, you know, about how they are ethical. You know, and you know, if you talk to the CEO of Shell, he'll say, my main concern is the safety of our consumers. And you talk to the head of Ford's, my main concern is the safety of the people that buy our cars. You know, they all have their kind of little spiel and little story. And you know, whenever you kind of look at a Shell, I'm not a sponsor, I shouldn't be saying this, but, you know, or any kind of...
They're robust enough to cope.
Any kind of petrol, you know, kind of company, right? You will find that they have all these incredibly beautiful green images, you know, everything is phenomenally clean. And it looks like a religious program, you know, sort of about the better things in life. And you kind of wish, well, it'd be nice if you had a capitalist that actually spoke about their class interest. This is what we are about, we want profit. We're there to make kind of money. So you got this kind of situation where, because of the inability to kind of give meaning to commitment, we've adopted a language that is so dishonest and so self-deceptive that we almost never ever question it. I mean, give you an example. What I think, I haven't seen a single person, newspaper columnist, criticize this. I don't know if you recall, but when the coalition government came into power, they undertook a promise not to make any cuts whatsoever. Not a penny would be cut from overseas aid. Right? They've said, that's the one thing, we're ring-fencing. We're going to cut, you know, childcare here, you know, we're going to cut, you know, NHS this, you know, we're going to cut, you know, local authority grants for libraries, you know, but we're not going to cut overseas aid. Now, why did they say that? Was it because you and I and the British public were so passionately committed to making sure that there was the overseas aid to Tanzania or to Burma was kept up to the previous level? Of course it wasn't. The reason why is because this was their way of saying that we are really not driven by the politics of interest. That we're so altruistic, we're such nice guys, right, that instead of worrying about ourselves and what's happening in our own backyards, where we are ruthlessly cutting everything left and right, we're going to ring-fence this precious amount of money that we're giving to the poor people over there. That's basically was the message. And I would have thought that somebody might have said a few words. I said, well, you know, how did you arrive at this particular calculation? But nobody dared raise any criticism. Nobody dared even give a hint of a suggestion to say, well, actually, why don't we just cut the overseas aid? I mean, what's wrong with that? I mean, if we're cutting, you know, libraries or we're cutting hospitals, you know, why not do it there as well? I'm not saying we should, but nobody raised that as an option or a possibility, because that would have been really bad taste, right? I mean, that would have been going beyond the pale to kind of raise a question like that. And you see, it's now come to the point where, for example, you got these guys and gals out in front of St. Paul's Cathedral who claim that they represent 99%. As I wrote in Spiked, 99% is a very high number. It's a very, very high number. That literally means everybody. Right? That literally means, you know, except for a couple of overweight, nasty capitalists who are somehow manipulating the whole world, probably two of them, everybody else is all together. Now, there's a number of criticisms you can make about the 99% figure, but the most important criticism I would make is that when you basically say that we're all the same, that we represent this mass block of people, what you're saying is that there really isn't any conflict of interest within that 99%. And that's what you're saying. We are 99%. Now, I don't know how much you know about world history, about human development, but the only time that you ever get near 99% is when Attila the Hun invades your country, right? It's when the hordes are out there, and it's one of the few times that you actually realize that this woman you really hate, you got more in common with than with Attila the Hun, and that, you know, person who's exploiting you, you know, at least speaks the same language, and we're going to do something there. Those things don't really exist. And it seems to me that, you know, when you have a figure like 99% being trotted, and that being then taken seriously, and then having political commentators and church leaders and businessmen, and even, I mean, even got to the point where a number of what I would call right-wing commentators all saying, isn't this wonderful? Wonderful children, look how much they're giving up, you know, camping out there, you know, sort of, you know, having a nice time, but, you know, they're doing it for all of us, for the 99%. And essentially, what these apolitical slogans actually do, because they also make the point that they haven't got any political demands, they're not really fighting for anything specific, they've got no leaders, there's no hierarchy, you know, everything is just there. You know, it's a completely sort of unclear kind of situation. What they are really saying, and this is what's really important about the 99%, is that their so-called solidarity, and I don't think it is solidarity, is forged around an indifference to personal or individual interest. In other words, it's a kind of quasi-religious solidarity. It's only quasi-religious groups who can somehow transcend the individual tensions that exist in this room, outside of this room, and anywhere else. Those kind of tensions of which the stuff of politics is made out of, it kind of transcend that, and basically saying we're indifferent, we're not interested in anything that separates us, divides us, and all the rest of that. And I think that's a very, very, very big problem, because one of the things that we learn from history is that true solidarity, without exception, always is forged around the enunciation and the representation and the codification of interests. There's nothing wrong with interests. It's not being selfish. It's a way of expressing in philosophical or political or sociological terms, you know, what it is that you and I have in common. It may be something that we have in common that conflicts with those people, but at least by explaining what it is that is our interest, it opens up the basis for a conversation, for a dialogue, a controversy, a debate, and maybe even a bitter political conflict. Now, solidarity, I would suggest to you, can take on two forms. There's two types of solidarity, and both forms of solidarity are rather feeble at the moment. But from a logical, conceptual point of view, it's useful to distinguish them. There's, first of all, what I would call pre-political solidarity. And that's the solidarity that you have between family members, between friends, between neighbors, between people that you meet in informal spaces. Pre-political solidarity is both logically and chronologically prior to any other form of solidarity. If we don't trust each other at a very basic pre-political level, it's unimaginable that you can have social or political solidarity, which is the other form of solidarity. And basically, the way to understand is that the pre-political solidarity is about the informal domain of our experience. The political social solidarity is about the way we are engaging in public life and the decisions we make about coming together, not because we are informally linked, but because we made a decision to formalize that relationship. Or another way of putting the same thing, pre-political solidarity is based on a legacy of shared experiences. It's about the past. It's about past experiences that are organic to our lives, which we continue to nourish and cultivate and give some kind of meaning to. Whereas social solidarity is not about the past. It's not about the legacy of shared experiences. It's about the future. It's about looking forward to sharing experiences in the future, experiences that we contribute to in the way that we sort of imagine sort of that kind of solidarity. So I think that those are the two ways in which solidarity can be expressed. And it seems to me that one of the big questions that we're faced with is that both forms of solidarity presuppose that we have a language through which we can express that. Both forms of solidarity presuppose that we feel comfortable in the domain of informal, taken for granted, pre-political relations, and equally that we have the confidence to go out and have political debates and arguments to see if there's some issues, some questions that can bind together people from different sections of society towards certain future objectives. One of the things that we're doing here at the Battle of Ideas in a very basic kind of form, which I think is very positive, is we're giving people an opportunity to express their views and to expose those views to alternative sentiments. Because we recognize that it's only through this kind of discussion that we can find a language through which we can sort of develop ideas with to experiment. And it seems to me that the kind of challenge that we have in order to even begin to address the issue of solidarity in any meaningful sense, and something that perhaps Claire can think about for the year ahead and in terms of what the Institute of Ideas does, is to take language a little bit more seriously. I know that when you talk about language, there's a danger of being a little bit idealistic and just up there. It doesn't really matter. But language is very important for the very simple reason that we think, conceptualize, we reflect to ourselves through language. When I think about the problems that I'm going to be discussing here, I need language to find my way. And it's only if we have the vocabulary that's oriented towards issues like solidarity, issues to do with the political problems of our time, that we can even begin to move in the right kind of direction. Let me just end by indicating some of the words that we need to take a little bit more seriously. We need to talk about judgment a lot more. In a world where non-judgmentalism is stigmatized, it is truly important that judging, or the old Greek virtue of phronesis, the virtue of judgment, is taken a little bit more seriously. We need to give more linguistic thought to the word of discretion, and how we give discretion, which is a very important element in political calculations, more importance. We need to be able to be more blunt, get to the point, and not hide behind words in the way that we're now encouraged to do, in order to create a kind of atmosphere where debate acquires greater moral status. We need to have a language that encourages people to believe in their moral autonomy and their moral independence. And in a world where we're continually told that human beings are irrational, and where governments tell us that because we're irrational, they need to come in and give us a prescription as to how we should behave, the question of moral autonomy itself becomes quite important. But most important of all, what we need to be involved with is a very systematic process of deconstruction, where we become a little bit braver in continually putting to question all those mainstream ideas that are beyond debate. All those arguments about not cutting a penny for overseas aid. All those arguments that somehow the protests that are going on are beyond questioning. All those things, all those truisms, and there are millions of them, that are almost never, ever challenged in a systematic sense. And I think if we can do that, then the question of how we solidarize, at least at the pre-political level, if not yet at the social level, will begin to fall in place. And that seems to me the best, most constructive way forward of taking our discussions and doing something positive, just in order to make sure that solidarity isn't just simply an abstract ideal, but is something that we are not just imagining, but giving meaning to the words that we use.
Thank you very much, Frank. I mean, I've taken an executive decision that I'm not going to take questions because I've got a number of thank yous to make and Frank's got to get a taxi. So, pragmatism, and I just think that did give us lots to think about, and I just know that the questions won't be adequately dealt with. So if you don't mind, that's what I'm going to do. It doesn't matter whether you mind. You just told me, Right, taking language seriously, so you mean all that, carrying on. Right, I now just want to kind of wrap this up, but I have a number of things that I need to wrap it up in relation to. First of all, to tell you that the debate will carry on, not just in the way that Frank explained in terms of thinking through some of these important issues, but actually just very practically, the battle of ideas, to a certain extent, is not yet over, because the battle satellite programme is carrying on through for a few weeks. So just to remind you that on Tuesday evening, there's a battle satellite in Brighton on Is Technology Making Us Smarter or Dumber? That we're going to be next week in Warsaw on Thursday discussing Does History Matter? Discussing on Saturday 21st Century Architecture. We're having a debate on the battle for democracy in Delhi in India before the end of the month, and also a debate on over-regulation in Frankfurt in Germany. So there's still, wherever you are, opportunities to actually practically just carrying on battling. There's also an opportunity for you to carry on the debate, I hope, by getting involved in the Institute of Ideas, joining the Institute of Ideas itself, partly because we want to expand the number of people that we know and work with, partly because we appreciate and need your financial assistance. It's not a huge amount of money to join, but it's a huge amount of money to us when it comes together. So that's one appeal. Secondly, there's going to be a second version of the Academy, which we launched last year in July, which is only open to Institute of Ideas members, which is a residential 3-day event at which we discussed last year the classics and history and the whole history of consciousness. This year, based around the theme of free will, we're going to look at that through both history, through classics, and also through literature. And we'd like more of you to come along and join in with that. We'd like your ideas for sessions for next year and throughout the year in terms of contributing to both the Battle of Ideas itself, to its programme, to its UK satellites, to its international satellites. And so there's plenty of opportunities at that level. The session that we've just had has been called Alone Together and is about social solidarity. Maybe this is an example of pre-political solidarity, but let me assure you, this event would not have been possible unless we'd actually worked together on it. On the one hand, I want to just say to those of you who left, and there's been a couple of thousand of people here over the weekend, that the contributions from the floor, which I encourage people to be frank and open and raise interesting questions, people took me at my word, and I've myself, in the discussions I've been in, found those contributions excellent and helpful and interesting, and obviously not all of them, some of them were dull and boring, but broadly speaking, actually really useful. And in all seriousness, the debates actually have genuinely been a conversation, I think, between all of us, which I hope will carry on. So we couldn't have done it without, obviously, an audience. We couldn't have done it without a fantastic range of speakers prepared to give up their time and so on over the weekend. Made it happen without support of our partners, our sponsors, the wonderful and never to be allowed to be criticised Shell, who obviously we're not discussing earlier, the Royal College of Art, our fantastic host here, PricewaterhouseCooper, SAB Miller. I don't just mention these people in passing. There's a whole range of media partners as well. I want to say genuinely thank you to everyone whose logo is in this brochure, because it's not just branding, it's not just nonsense. This event could not happen without those people supporting it, just as well as it could not happen without people like Frank Faraday speaking at it. So can we just show our appreciation of both the partners and the speakers, please? Particularly want to thank the Hargreaves Trust and Ian Hargreaves for being, for the second year running, our youth champion that has facilitated sixth formers attending the festival at a much reduced rate and a number of half-price student tickets. Actually, that's enormously important and very helpful, but I don't know if Ian's in the room, but thank you very much. We really, really genuinely appreciated that. Can we give... I'm sure many of you benefited from it as well. You can sneak off whenever you need, so I can see you. It's just, like, irritatingly shuffling. Right, yes, thank you very much. Frank Ferrady, by the way. I'd like to thank our particular thanks, in terms of speakers, to our international guests. There's been a range of people in the audience and on panels who participated in the International Battle Satellite Programme, have helped put on debates in, you know, everywhere from Switzerland to Venice to Athens. And I think the experience of having people from all around the world contributing to these debates, I have personally found enormously enriching. And I think that we have a huge amount to learn from each other and the different experiences we're going. We can't possibly have any sense of solidarity unless we actually have that solidarity beyond the shores of the UK. Not in some sort of faux, you know, hands across the sea way, but actually in the sense of meeting the most interesting people around Europe, around the world, and getting them involved in the battle of ideas. So can we thank those people coming across to London and participating? We speak, there are people carrying on outside working. We've had a fantastic volunteer team working over the weekend. I know that they are not volunteering because it'll look good on their CV and it'll help them get a job. I know that they are volunteering because they're passionately committed to this event, and a lot of them actually, you know, are students who are hard up, who actually pay for themselves to come down. We don't provide accommodation, you know. We're skint, but we're mean. And so they all come and do it, and they work their guts out. Can we really, really thank the volunteers? I'd like to also thank WorldRight, who've been filming throughout. Kerry and Viv and team, every year, come to this festival, both film it, well, they don't just film it, they're participating all the time. Fantastic team of volunteers, fantastic youth charity. If you don't know about them, you should find out about them. They run a channel called World Bites. Somebody in the individualism session complained that everybody was sitting at home watching TV, which I do from time to time. But anyway, one TV channel you should watch is World Bites, run by World Bite. Can we thank the team around World Bites? The way that the Battle of Ideas works is that it's put together by a Battle of Ideas committee of about 45 people who volunteer their time to produce and think about the different sessions. And they're all people, they don't work for the Institute of Ideas, they're people who've got actively involved. And we work, literally, we'll be having our, you know, first meeting in November and we'll start again. You might want to be part of that for next year. But those people have worked really hard. It's been a year happening. We obviously have a lot of other things that are going on throughout the year as well. But I'd really like to thank that Battle of Ideas committee who have produced the sessions, chaired the sessions, and particularly mention Dolan Cummings, who used to work for the Institute of Ideas, but basically carries on working with the Institute of Ideas in many ways and gets all those blurbs and ideas together with a team of us and acts as our editorial, the main guy in charge of the editorial of the content of the blurbs on the website. And also to thank Simon Belt, who gives us a lot of technical support, even though he runs a Manchester salon. Can we give particular thanks there to all the Battle of Ideas committee, Simon Belt and Dolan Cummings. I want to extend a particular thanks, because one of the things that's very important to this festival is that although it's in a working art college, the downside of it being in a working art college is that we have to kind of bring the chairs in, set up the whole festival, build it from scratch. And we have, it's not a purpose-built conference venue, as you will have noticed. And That's not to say that it's not a perfect place for us, but I'm just saying it's not. And one of the things that therefore is a challenge when you do that is the challenge is how you get all of those sessions to run professionally and make sure that everybody's heard. But we actually don't worry about that anymore because we discovered when we started doing this a man called Vic Brent. I don't know whether he's in the room, but hopefully this is on film. But anyway, Vic Brent and his ABC. Where is it? There he is. Vic Brent, George, Eddie, Seb, Lee, all of the guys, right? Absolutely fantastic. They work with us. We'll phone them up and we'll say, we've built a room, we don't know what to do about this. This is going to happen, we've got this. And Vic says, fine. That's fine, Claire. Yeah. And he says, fine, Jeff, because I never phone anyone. Anyway, can we just say, what a fantastic job. We really appreciate all the hard work you do. Thanks, guys. It's brilliant. As always. Okay, my final bit is obviously that I need to thank my own colleagues in the Institute of Ideas office. We work with a number of, throughout the year, people intern in the office. We don't pay anything, but they become part of our team. And I just wanted to particularly mention Paul and Anwar, who have worked very hard in the build-up to this as our intern. So Paul's at the back there anyway, but can we just give them a round of applause? The Debating Matters team, who, while we're all running around organising the Battle of Ideas, have put on the Debating Matters events for debates for sixth formers 16 to 18 throughout the UK and throughout India at the same time as we're organising the Battle of Ideas. So to Tony, Justine, Helen, Jason and until recently Abby, cheers guys for putting up with us while we're doing that. And then to my fantastic Battle of Ideas colleagues, Craig Fernington, David Bowden, who's organised the UK Battle Satellite programme for the second year brilliantly well and started off when we first met him as a sixth former in through Debating Matters and now kind of runs this fantastic programme. To Patrick Hayes, who runs our promotions and press, as well as being a brilliant journalist at the same time for Spite. To Angus Kennedy, who has become a backbone of the office and also is the director of our International Battle Satellite Programme. Can I just say thank you very much indeed. Couldn't do it without you. This is the team. They really deserve a drink. Give them a big round of applause. In case you think I've gone mad, the person that I need to thank more than anyone is the person who is absolutely the linchpin of this festival, and that is the one and only Mr. Jeff Kidder. At the start of this festival, it's traditional to say, "Let battle commence," and in many ways, it's the appropriate way to end this festival too. I think that the world that we live in today throws up the most enormous challenges. Sometimes it's really scary out there. We know that we live in serious times. The thing which will stop those serious times frightening us all into isolation and atomisation is ourselves. The fact that over this weekend, over 2,000 people, 2,500, whatever people, came throughout this weekend, argued, debated on every single issue that you could think of, took themselves seriously enough to do that. That is what will make a difference in these serious times. We bloody well need each other. We need to actually develop those ideas and our arguments far better than they are at the moment. We need to hold each other to account intellectually. We have to not be frightened of offending each other. We need to tolerate each other's arguments when we disagree with them, but ruthlessly criticise them at the same time, because that's a way of showing each other respect. And if we do that, and we're tough about it, then we stand a bit of a chance. Only a bit, but it's worth a shot. And what else are we going to do? Let battle commence. See you in the student union.